Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Sam Jacob, and today we are wading into a truly explosive set of sources.
And I'm Alex Parker. We are here to bring you the crucial, distilled insights from the stack of investigations provided by the Mother Jones for November and December 2025 issue.
Yeah, it's quite a collection.
It really is. This deep dive is necessary because, well, what these sources reveal is an extraordinarily detailed look at the machinery of power that was constructed with frightening speed in late 2025.
Our mission, then, is to unpack the most significant investigations presented in this issue for you.
Mm-hmm.
We're focusing on, I guess, three major fronts.
That's right. First, the massive and, frankly, quite brutal expansion of the federal security state.
Okay.
Second, the coordinated counter efforts being mounted by blue states to, you know, resist this shift.
And third,
the often hidden but deeply influential forces, religious, financial, political, shaping U.S. policy abroad and the economy right here at home.
So a lot to cover. What's the common thread here?
The overarching theme that really knits all these findings together is striking, and we need to understand it right from the jump. It's the rapid, almost overwhelming rollout of the administration's agenda.
Right.
And it's often financed by an unprecedented gusher of federal cash. This push is provoking intense, personal, and sometimes, well, contradictory reactions across the country.
So it's showing us a nation kind of at war with itself over resources, ideology.
Exactly. And even over the very definition of reality itself.
Okay. Let's unpack this immediately. Let's start with what the sources term the American Gulag. It's a deep investigation into the unprecedented scale of government power and, well, profiteering under these new security mandates.
Right. The initial data point that just jumped off the page is the funding mechanism. This massive expansion, it was financed through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which passed back in July.
And that bill handed U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, an unprecedented, $74.9
billion. $74.9
billion. Yeah. Pause on that number for a second. $74.9 billion. The sources make this chilling comparison. That figure is double the entire budget ICE operated on under the previous administration.
Double.
And it makes ICE's annual spending comparable to the military spending of all but eight countries globally. That's the budget of a standing army, basically, dedicated to internal enforcement.
Absolutely. And this money is going straight into infrastructure. $45 billion is explicitly earmarked for new detention centers.
$45 billion just for buildings?
Just for the facilities. The objective is to have the capacity to detain 107,000 people by the end of the year.
107,000 beds.
Yeah. And to achieve this, we are talking about 50 new facilities expected to open, many of them these massive tent camps, adding to the 186 centers already in operation as of September.
The logistics of that alone, securing land, utilities, staffing these places in just months.
It underscores the sheer overwhelming political will driving this project. It's a massive undertaking.
And the scale is already very real, right?
Yeah.
By August, the number of people in immigration detention hit an ICE record.
61,226, a record high.
What stood out to me, and what's critical for you, the listener, to grasp, is the nature of this population. 70% of those people had no criminal convictions whatsoever.
70%.
We're not talking about hardened criminals. We're discussing people primarily held for civil administrative infractions.
That is the crucial distinction, isn't it? When 70% of a massive detention population is comprised of individuals with no criminal history, you are looking at an internal enforcement and administrative system.
Not a public safety measure.
Exactly. It is a mechanism for mass civil detention, which, as the Feature Minority Report implies, requires a fundamental shift in how ICE operates and, crucially, whom they hire.
Okay. That brings us directly to the force multiplier investigation. Because to staff a system this vast, they need an army of agents. But, well, traditional recruitment simply can't keep up.
Right. The One Big Beautiful Bill pays for 10,000 additional agents over 5 years, which nearly doubles the current force.
10,000 more agents.
But to get them, they are compensating for that massive hiring spree by dramatically lowering the standards.
How low are we talking?
The bar has been dropped, well, significantly. Previously, officers had to be between 21 and 40 years old. Now, officers can be as young as 18.
18?
18, and there is no upper age limit anymore.
Wow. And the training?
The training period, historically a 16-week course at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, FLETC,
right.
It was cut in half.
Half. So 8 weeks.
8 weeks. And even the required firearms training was reduced. Imagine sending an 18-year-old with 8 weeks of training and, you know, reduced tactical practice out to conduct complex, often confrontational, interior enforcement operations.
That seems risky.
To say the least.
And here's where it gets really interesting regarding practical enforcement and, well, operational capacity. They completely eliminated the 5-week basic Spanish proficiency course.
Gone. After being standard for years.
Replaced by what? An app?
Replaced by a live translation tool. Essentially an app.
Yeah, the operational implications of that, I mean, that seems staggering.
It is. Eliminating basic Spanish proficiency means agents are now reliant on often glitchy technology in high-stakes, rapidly evolving field situations.
Which increases the risk of miscommunication, due process violations.
Absolutely. The political calculation here seems to be that speed and volume of deportations outweigh the need for linguistic competence or, frankly, robust training.
And it doesn't stop there. Adding to this sense of desperation for staffing, the administration is now openly calling for a volunteer force.
Yeah, civilian Department of Defense employees to support Customs and Border Protection and ICE in deportation operations.
Civilian DOD employees, not law enforcement.
Exactly. The sources noted that this call for a volunteer force is not standard procedure at all. It suggests the federal government anticipates needing a truly massive workforce to staff this rapidly expanding security state.
And they just can't fill the positions fast enough through normal recruitment, even with the relaxed standards.
Precisely. The sheer demand is impossible to meet when, you know, historical data shows it takes about 500,000 applicants to yield 10,000 adequate hires.
And they only got, what, 100,000 applications?
Around that, as of August. Mm. So they are seeking to leverage existing federal employees, regardless of their training in law enforcement, just to expedite deportations.
So if Force Multiplier shows us the bureaucracy expanding and standards dropping, the features Minority Report and Random House show us who's cashing in, this detention gold rush.
And the lack of transparency, coupled with these blatant political connections, it's impossible to ignore.
Okay, let's look at the tech side first. BI Technologies.
Right. A Massachusetts-based firm. They landed a no-bid contract worth up to $10 million for its iris scanning mobile app called Morris.
Morris. Inmate recognition and identification system.
Yeah. This app allows ICE agents to query a database containing some 5 million biometric records right there in the field.
And the key political mechanism here, the connection to the administration.
That's the crucial part. BII had struggled for years, apparently, to crack the federal market. Then, suddenly, they secure this lucrative no-bid deal shortly after hiring Ballard Partners.
Ballard Partners, a lobbying shop that runs right into the heart of the administration. We're talking Brian Ballard, a major influence peddler.
And his associates, including Susie Wiles, the president's chief of staff, and Attorney General Pam Bondi, who was also a Ballard alum. It's deeply connected.
So it's a textbook example of influence translating directly into these highly profitable no-bid contracts for, well, controversial surveillance tech.
Exactly. BI wasn't chosen necessarily for superior technology. It seems it was chosen for its superior Rolodex.
And the lack of competitive bidding means the taxpayer is almost certainly overpaying.
Very likely. For an unvetted product, all to enrich a politically connected firm.
And they aren't the only Ballard client benefiting, right? There's SNA International.
SNA International, a Virginia-based company. They were awarded a no-bid contract worth up to $25 million. For what?
For DNA testing of immigrant families.
DNA testing. That raises immediate red flags for critics, doesn't it?
It does. Critics fear that this expansion of DNA collection could potentially lay the groundwork for increased family separations, or at least for increased surveillance and data collection on migrant families.
Even though DHS claims it's meant to annihilate human trafficking.
Right. But the timing, occurring alongside the resurrection of family detention, with nearly 9,000 beds set aside for families by year's end, is incredibly troubling to civil liberties advocates.
Then we have the Fort Bliss contract. This one is detailed in the feature Random House, and it involves, well, jaw-dropping incompetence and financial manipulation, it seems.
This concerns the $1.26 billion contract awarded to a company called Acquisition Logistics.
$1.26 billion.
Billion. To build and operate a massive new tent city detention center at Fort Bliss, Texas.
And the more you examine this contract, the more bizarre the details become. Acquisition Logistics. It's a very small firm. Operates out of a single-family home in Richmond, Virginia. The CEO is 77, apparently circling retirement. before this massive award, their largest federal contract was just $16
million. $16 million to $1.26 billion.
And crucially, they have absolutely no prior experience in incarceration or massive construction projects of this scale. None.
Yet they won a $1.26 billion contract for what's expected to be the biggest tent city detention facility in the country. How? How did a tiny, inexperienced firm win a contract like this, bypassing giants like CoreCivic or GEO Group?
This is where we need to explain the contracting mechanism that seems to have been abused. The Navy.
The Navy, not ISU or the Army, where the base is.
Correct. The Navy awarded the contract for a facility on an Army base, and they did this by bypassing standard competition via a small business set-aside.
Okay, explain that for us. A set-aside.
So for you listening, a set-aside is meant to ensure that genuinely small businesses get a fair chance at smaller, achievable government work. Usually, these are limited to contracts under, say, $50 million. To use it for a multi-year, $1.26 billion project on an Army base awarded by the Navy. Well, it's a textbook example of circumvention, according to experts in the sources.
One government contracting expert noted in the sources, it's like a guy who is running a one taxi firm suddenly getting a giant transportation contract to run the nation's railway system.
Exactly. The firm, Acquisition Logistics, is clearly acting as a front for subcontractors who are the real beneficiaries.
And the key player among those subcontractors is
Disaster Management Group, or DMG. DMG is owned by Nathan Elbers.
A known GOP donor.
With direct financial connections to the Trump family, yes. Therefore, the $1.26 billion contract becomes a massive pass-through of taxpayer money to a politically connected donor for a contract that really should have been competitively bid.
Despite the firm having no relevant experience.
Yeah.
And didn't one of its predecessor companies have issues?
Yes. Apparently pleaded guilty to hiring undocumented workers previously. It seems to be an operation built entirely on political leverage, not merit.
What's fascinating here is how the administration is leveraging different parts of the Pentagon, like the Navy, which is often seen as, you know, highly professional and removed from internal politics in unusual ways.
To accelerate the detention push and circumvent standard procedures.
Yeah.
The source noted the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, is currently investigating this deal.
But construction has already begun.
Which is the whole point, right? The money is flowing and the facilities are being built while the investigations crawl forward.
Okay, this brings us to the actual grim reality inside these new facilities. Let's focus on the feature Camp Fear, or the notorious Alligator Alcatraz in Florida.
This facility, announced by Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer, sounds less like a temporary facility and more like, well, intentional cruelty.
The name itself, Alligator Alcatraz, comes from the remote location in the Everglades.
Surrounded by natural hazards like alligators and pythons, Uthmeyer explicitly said the location was chosen because if detainees tried to escape, there was nowhere to go, nowhere to hide.
And the cost?
The daily operating cost alone is estimated at $245 per bed. That leads to an annual operating cost of around $450 million for a facility designed to house roughly 5,000 people.
$450 million a year? What about the conditions?
The reported conditions are terrible, and you really need to grasp this. We're talking about flooded tents, malfunctioning AC in the humid Florida climate, scarce food.
And cages.
Chain link cages.
Yeah.
Each giant tent holds 8 chain link cages, built to contain 32 detainees each.
32 people in one cage.
16 bunk beds and 3 toilets per cage, creating conditions of extreme overcrowding and, well, lack of basic sanitation.
But the truly disturbing element, detailed in the ACLU lawsuit cited by the sources, is the report of psychological warfare and deliberate cruelty.
Yeah, mosquitoes and sun exposure were apparently used as a form of punishment and retaliation, with restrained individuals placed outside for hours.
And perhaps the most shocking anecdote, the intellectually disabled detainee.
Tricked into signing a voluntary departure form in exchange for a blanket, deported without finishing his removal proceedings.
We can't just move past that detail quickly. It illustrates the focus isn't on due process or even minimum humanitarian standards.
It seems to be on rapid, absolute removal, using deceit and the desperation caused by terrible conditions to achieve quotas. This isn't governance. It feels more like punitive social engineering.
And the attempt to stop it shows the political determination, doesn't it? Judge Kathleen Williams ordered the facility shut down,
citing environmental concerns and the potential impact on the nearby Miccosukee tribe.
Right.
But the appellate court blocked that order almost immediately,
allowing the state to resume accepting detainees, yeah.
And what's fascinating, or it may be alarming, about this aggressive anti-oversight model is the copycat phenomenon.
Other red state governors are adopting this blueprint. The sources mention Nebraska's proposed Cornhusker Clink and Indiana's Speedway Slammer.
So Florida's strategy, using political leverage, remote land, legal obstruction to create intentionally cruel detention conditions, has become the national standard for this new security state.
It seems that way. Okay, if you synthesize this first section, we see a massive, immediate, and politically connected effort to build what feels like a permanent parallel justice system for immigrants.
Lavishly funded, run largely by private contractors who seem to prioritize political loyalty over competence or basic human dignity.
Okay, now let's pivot sharply away from the security state. Let's move to section two, which details domestic economic warfare and the countermeasures being mounted by blue states.
And we start with an incredible irony located deep inside a reliable red state. The economic assault on the IRS in Ogden, Utah.
Right. Ogden, Utah. This is a perfect illustration of how rigid political loyalty can clash violently with local economic reality.
Absolutely. Ogden is solidly MAGA territory. About 60% of residents voted for Trump. Yet before this administration arrived, the IRS processing center was the single biggest employer in the area.
Employing about 7,500 people. It was an economic pillar for Ogden.
A huge pillar. And then the cuts, driven by the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, led by Elon Musk, arrived.
DOGE. For you listening, DOGE's mandate is essentially to dismantle parts of the civil service they deem inefficient or politically hostile. The sources describe the attack as a chain thaw to the civil service.
And the impact was immediate. Thousands of probationary workers were fired immediately. Others were pushed out through the deferred resignation program.
Which is basically take a buyout now or face being fired later without benefits.
Essentially, yeah. Nationally, the IRS had hemorrhaged about 26,000 people by early June. That's over a quarter of its workforce.
26,000. And in Ogden.
Union officials expected about 1,500 local job losses by the end of September. The human cost detailed in the source material is profound because, well, this was more than just a job. It was a community resource.
Also,
the IRS office was known for being diverse, LGBTQ friendly, and accommodating. It offered crucial flexibility, remote work options, and specific accommodations for veterans and people with disabilities.
And then the new rigid 9-to-5 in-office mandates were enforced.
Right. And many longtime employees were forced into early retirement because they simply couldn't manage the inflexible schedule due to chronic health issues or caregiving responsibilities. It broke the model that worked for them.
So it's not just about cutting dead weight. It's about systematically dismantling the infrastructure that supports a diverse, stable workforce.
Exactly. And the most poignant quotes in the sources came from those walked out the door. People were crying, saying, "How could he do this? I voted for him, but this is not what I voted for."
Wow. Their political beliefs about shrinking government suddenly collided with the reality of economic devastation in their own city, their own lives.
A very harsh collision.
And the economic fallout extends far beyond Ogden, right? This is a national story. These cuts are being dubbed a tax cut for tax cheats.
Yeah, Yale's budget lab estimated that a 50% cut to the IRS workforce could result in a net revenue loss of, well, the range is huge, $350 billion to potentially $2.4 trillion over a decade.
$2.4 trillion. Why is the number so high? How does cutting IRS staff lose money?
It's because the IRS's enforcement agents aren't interchangeable. It is difficult and time-consuming to audit complex global firms and high-net-worth individuals who utilize sophisticated tax shelters.
Really complex cases.
Exactly. These complex audits generate the largest returns for the federal government. By targeting experienced agents and cutting the overall workforce, the administration is effectively guaranteeing that large-scale tax avoidance schemes, the kind that wealthy donors often utilize, will go unpunished.
Which costs the Treasury potentially trillions.
That's the estimate, yeah.
This raises an important question, then. Why is the local Republican delegation representatives like Blake Moore and Senator Mike Lee either supporting the cuts or completely silent while their own constituents lose jobs?
The sources identify this as political avoidance, driven by fear, essentially. Blake Moore, despite the economic crisis in his district, declined to sign a letter acknowledging the IRS's importance to the community.
And ironically, he's a co-chair of a congressional DOGE committee.
That's right. This silence contrasts sharply with the furious pushback Utah leaders mounted in the 1990s to save Hill Air Force Base from closure.
So what's different now?
According to a local professor quoted in the sources, the difference now is that the delegation is terrified of Donald Trump and prioritizing political loyalty over pragmatic local governance and constituent jobs.
Even in Ogden itself,
yeah,
the community response was mixed.
Yeah, even as hundreds showed up to a job fair aimed at former IRS workers, the source notes the community response ranged from indifferent to hostile, with people apparently cheering the demise of the IRS on local Facebook groups.
Compounding the distress of those who lost their jobs.
Absolutely. This segment really shows us the cost of the agenda when it meets reality. Loyal communities are sacrificed to fulfill an ideological mandate, and the result is devastating both locally and nationally in terms of lost revenue.
Okay, let's shift dramatically now to California, which is leading the resistance. The feature Outfront lays out California's strategy for an economic uprising and this idea of soft secession against the federal government's assault.
Right. The context for California's fury is both financial and ideological. California is a massive net donor to the federal government.
How much?
The state pays $80 billion more in taxes than it receives back in federal benefits. $80 billion a year.
Which illustrates the profound irony of the makers versus takers rhetoric often employed by Republicans. California is essentially financing the expansion of the security state it despises.
Precisely. And the attacks on California have been specific and personal, leveraging federal power to punish the state.
Like what?
The sources detail the administration demanding voter ID laws just to release wildfire aid, revoking UCLA grants over spurious anti-Semitism charges, and demanding the end of gender-affirming care in its hospitals, regardless of state law.
These abuses have led to this concept of uncooperative federalism.
Yeah. This isn't the violent rupture of 1861, but rather blue states building parallel systems and withholding cooperation to render federal authority sort of meaningless within their borders.
And California is flexing its considerable economic muscle. It's the world's fourth largest economy, right?
Fourth largest. So it has leverage.
What does that soft secession look like in practice? The blueprint involves countervalue rebellion, making federal aggression politically and financially painful for Republican constituents.
That's the idea. Primarily through financial leverage. California could begin disinvesting state pension funds from red state companies.
Like AT&T, ExxonMobil, Tesla.
Yeah.
Companies that rely on California's massive capital.
Exactly. For stability. They could also proactively lure away crucial professionals, doctors, tech workers, electricians, with relocation bonuses.
Pulling talent out of red states.
And selectively terminate professional licensing reciprocity with uncooperative states, making it harder for those states to maintain critical infrastructure and services, kind of an economic squeeze.
There was also the crucial element of interstate cooperation mentioned.
Yes, the sources highlight the West Coast Health Alliance. California, Oregon, and Washington, joined quickly by Hawaii.
Formed to do what?
Formed to create their own vaccine standards and distribution protocols, essentially ignoring federal guidance from the Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Setting their own health policies.
And furthermore, they are exploring creating interstate criminal task forces to prosecute corruption and environmental violations that the federal Justice Department, acting as the administration's, quote, goon squad, is ignoring.
So bypassing the feds entirely on enforcement.
The strategy is built on the fact that blue states represent 75% more in state investments and budgets than red trifectas. By making political aggression cost Republican states economically, California hopes to force a change in calculus.
Okay, connecting this crackdown to the resistance strategy is Representative Greg Caesar's roadmap.
Mm.
Caesar, a young progressive, he embodies the struggle of his generation.
Yeah, caught between an older, cautious Democratic guard and an opposition willing to break Democratic rules, like the Texas GOP redrawing him into a primary against a 16-term Democrat.
So Caesar's dilemma is immediate. Surviving a primary after being redrawn into the same district as Lloyd Doggett.
Right. Caesar's strategy is to fight for his political life by delivering a clear, unapologetic, progressive agenda rooted in, well, populist simplicity.
He believes progressivism needs clear villains that working people can instantly recognize.
Exactly. The sources mention the IC contractor, CoreCivic, and Elon Musk.
Whom Caesar refers to with a Muckfusk sticker on his laptop.
Right. He argues that the Democratic Party has to focus on making working people feel that Democrats are the party for them through bold, universal solutions. He cites San Antonio's pre-K program as a model.
And his personal experience underscores the nature of the power they are fighting against.
Absolutely. Caesar attempted a legally mandated oversight visit to CoreCivic's T. Don Hutto detention facility.
To check on constituents being held without air conditioning in broiling Texas heat?
Yes. And CoreCivic simply ghosted him, refused to let him in, violating federal law. It underscores the impotence of congressional authority when the executive branch enables defiance by private contractors.
So Caesar's inability to access a facility holding his own constituents led him to a crucial strategic realization.
It seems so. He's now pushing California to scrap its nonpartisan redistricting commission.
Which is a difficult position for a progressive to take, right? Giving up on reform like that.
It is, but he argues that being a shining light on a hill is good for inspiration, but this fight is about power. You can't inspire former Confederate states to adopt independent redistricting.
So you have to fight fire with fire politically.
That's his argument. Maximize state-level power, even if it means sacrificing abstract reform goals.
It's an interesting shift from idealism to real politics.
It is. His belief is that unless the Democratic Party can successfully wield power and make working people feel that change is happening, like the bold, universal programs he advocates, they will continue to lose the battles against the kind of institutional corruption we saw in the first section.
Okay, let's transition now to section three. This deals with global power structures and the deep influence of Christian Zionism on U.S. foreign policy. The financial and political muscle of this movement, detailed in the feature God's Blank Check, is truly staggering.
The financial numbers alone confirm the status of Christian Zionism as a dominant force in lobbying. Yale Eckstein's International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, or IFCJ.
They raised how much?
$271 million in 2023.
$271 million. To put that in perspective for you, the listener, that amount is more than AIPAC and the ACLU Foundation combined.
Combined. And crucially, 92% of those donors are Christian. It shows the depth of evangelical commitment.
And their political clout is equally impressive. Christians United for Israel, CUFI.
Claims 10 million members, which is more than the total Jewish population in the U.S.
And this movement has deep penetration into the Trump administration.
Deep. With key figures like Mike Huckabee serving as ambassador to Israel and Pete Hegseth as defense secretary, this isn't just about political support. It's about direct policy implementation driven by faith.
What's the theological foundation for this political action?
It's purely theological. 82% of white evangelicals believe Israel was given to the Jewish people by God. This belief translates into policy because many believe the return of Jews to Israel, known as Aliyah, is a prerequisite for the Messiah's return.
Okay, but this end time scenario, it contains a harsh element, doesn't it?
It does. The idea that recalcitrant Jews and others who do not convert will perish. As Rabbi Jack Moline notes in the source, this belief system implies you have to break the eggs to get the omelet.
Meaning collateral damage is acceptable, maybe even necessary, for prophecy to be fulfilled.
That's the implication some critics draw, yes.
And this theology is translating directly into policy and action, with specific, sometimes, well, bizarre examples, like the story of the red heifers.
Right. A Texas businessman, Byron Stinson, spent over $500,000 locating and transporting five perfectly unblemished red cows to Israel.
For what purpose?
For a purification ritual. This ritual is considered by some fundamentalists to be a necessary religious step toward rebuilding the ancient temple in Jerusalem.
And critically, Hamas cited the arrival of these heifers as one of the motivating factors behind the October 7, 2023 attacks.
They did. Viewing it as a clear act of provocation aimed at Muslim holy sites.
The movement also heavily funds Aliyah, the immigration of Jews to Israel.
Yes. IFCJ and Kenneth Copeland Ministries have poured millions into helping over 30,000 Ukrainian Jews immigrate to Israel, viewing it explicitly as a prophetic sign.
And this influence extends even to current humanitarian policy in conflict zones like Gaza.
It does. The administration bypassed the UN to fund the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is run by Christian Zionist Johnny Moore.
And this foundation set up aid stations primarily in Israeli-controlled areas.
Yes, which has sadly led to hundreds of Palestinian civilian deaths near the sites, according to reports. Observers accuse the group of facilitating rather than mitigating forced displacement toward the south.
What's fascinating here is that the Christian support is now so robust that evangelical groups are being seen as, perhaps, a more reliable, politically influential source in Washington than even some traditional Jewish lobbying groups.
It seems that way. Netanyahu held a meet and greet for U.S. evangelical leaders before meeting with the president at the White House earlier this year. It suggests a recognition of where the true power base lies for his support in the U.S.
And that support is being cultivated aggressively by Israeli settler leaders, specifically Yossi Dagan.
Yes, the head of the Shomron Regional Council in the West Bank settlements. The feature, Lobbying for Annexation, details his aggressive influence campaign on U.S. soil.
Dagan isn't hiding his agenda, is he?
Not at all. He is aggressively lobbying U.S. officials like Paula White-Cain and Ambassador Huckabee to support the annexation of the West Bank. He uses carefully chosen gifts, like a glass map of the West Bank and mezuzahs, to solidify his message.
And the message is remarkably straightforward, rooted in shared theology.
Very direct. He tells members of Congress, according to the sources, "This land is ours. God gave it to us according to our faith, and also according to your faith, if you are Christian, it is written in the Bible."
Now, Dagon's efforts are backed by the Israeli Foreign Ministry. How much money?
Over $800,000 has been traced to his activities, yet he has not registered under FATR, the Foreign Agents Registration Act.
Okay, remind us what FARR is.
So, for you listening, a FARR requires individuals lobbying the U.S. government on behalf of a foreign political entity to disclose their funding, activities, and relationship with that foreign government. It's about transparency.
And the failure to register, despite massive foreign government backing, that raises significant questions.
Of legality and transparency, yes. As former DOJ official David Loffman noted in the sources, by not registering, Dagon operates in the shadows, able to influence U.S. policy directly without the typical disclosures required of foreign agents.
And Dagon's campaign isn't focused only on Washington, right? He's achieving state-level success.
That's right. Pushing legislation in states like Louisiana and Arkansas to mandate using the settler terminology Judea and Samaria instead of the internationally recognized West Bank in official documents.
Which is a subtle but potent act of redefining reality, legally asserting the Israeli claim across various U.S. state governments.
Exactly. The success of Dagon's lobbying illustrates that foreign policy in this administration is heavily influenced by a powerful, prophecy-driven Christian base, allowing foreign actors who align with that theology to operate, it seems, outside traditional lobbying scrutiny.
Okay. Let's transition now to Section 4, focusing on the cultural and information fronts, where the battle for narrative, economics, and truth is playing out, starting with the hypocrisy surrounding crypto and energy detailed in Windfall.
This is a story of political contradiction that, well, directly benefits the first family. Donald Trump publicly rails against ugly windmills that kill the birds and reduce property value.
He's actively blocking new wind and solar projects across the country, aligning with the fossil fuel lobby.
Right. Yet his son, Eric Trump, serving as chief strategy officer of American Bitcoin, is deeply involved in locking in cheap renewable energy for a massive Texas Bitcoin mine.
The Vega Data Center, powered by the Canadian Breaks wind farm, using exactly the green infrastructure the administration politically attacks.
The irony creates a massive financial advantage. By restricting new wind and solar infrastructure, which the sources estimate could drop deployment by 41% by 2028, the president is deliberately creating resource scarcity,
which makes the existing clean power resources already secured by his son's crypto venture even more valuable and scarcer for everyone else.
Exactly.
The sources emphasize the energy hunger of the crypto economy. Bitcoin mining. It consumes enormous amounts of electricity.
Sometimes rivaling the consumption of entire cities, crypto firms are gobbling up clean energy resources that previously supplied thousands of homes in Texas,
driving up utility rates for consumers who now have to pay more for electricity from more expensive, less efficient fossil fuel sources.
That's the reported effect. And what's fascinating here is the illusion of economic value, which the source is really debunk. Colin Reed, a professor who studied the economics of crypto.
What does he say?
He calls Bitcoin mining an industry that creates virtually no meaningful economic value and employs fewer people than a McDonald's.
Fewer than a McDonald's. Yet this industry is consistently rewarded with massive tax incentives and access to cheap infrastructure.
It seems so. So we see the playbook.
Right.
The administration attacks green energy ideologically to appease its base and donors,
while simultaneously the first family uses that very resource to fuel a highly profitable but economically thin venture.
They secure cheap power through political maneuvering and then benefit immensely when the administration restricts market competition. It's a closed-loop system, it appears, of ideological warfare masking financial self-enrichment.
And that self-enrichment is enabled by the same anti-regulatory stance we saw in the IRS cuts.
It looks that way. The price of Bitcoin is rising, partly due to the president's promise to defend Americans' right to mine, while simultaneously his administration is slashing SEC enforcement and tax oversight, making the crypto industry kind of a safe haven from scrutiny.
Okay, next, let's tackle the weaponization of language and policy. Specifically, the myth of the able-bodied and the ensuing Medicaid purge detailed in mixed media.
Right. The White House's Myth vs. Fact document used the trope of the able-bodied adult to justify new Medicaid work requirements. These were included in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
And this trope suggests they are only targeting lazy people, the mythical couch potatoes, who are perfectly able to work but choose not to, defining them as undeserving.
That's the framing. But the reality, as documented by the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO is far harsher.
What does the CBO estimate?
The CBO estimates the new work requirements will cause 5.3 million people to lose health coverage by 2034.
5.3 million.
And this loss is overwhelmingly expected to happen primarily through administrative burdens, the mountains of paperwork, red tape, complexity required to prove one's exemption or compliance.
So not a lack of desire or effort by recipients.
Mm.
It's the bureaucracy.
Overwhelmingly, yes. It's the bureaucracy tripping people up. The historical context here is crucial to understanding the policy's true intent, according to the sources.
How so?
The weaponization of the term able-bodied dates back almost 7 centuries, specifically to England's 1351 Statute of Laborers.
After the plague.
Exactly. After the bubonic plague had killed off much of the workforce, making labor scarce. The law was used to compel the surviving poor, deemed able in body, to work at low wages.
So this fantasy of a malicious freeloading class is an ancient justification for compelling cheap labor.
It's a very old trope. Therefore, the CBO estimates confirm that the policy is essentially a bureaucratic purge. It disproportionately targets those with invisible or chronic illnesses or those struggling with mental health issues.
People who are deemed capable enough to contribute to capitalism, but who are too sick, too exhausted, or simply unable to navigate the extreme complexity of the new certification system.
The rule punishes administrative failure, not genuine lack of work ethic.
And here is a deeply concerning wrinkle. The Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.,
infamous for his anti-vaccine views and for often blaming chronic illnesses on people's life choices.
He will define the parameters of the exemptions for these work requirements.
He will. Given his track record, this raises immense fears that people with invisible disabilities or those who might require significant administrative resources to prove their chronic illness may be purged from the roles due to, well, a hostile ideological interpretation of the rules.
Okay, finally, let's look at the cultural and information fronts, where battles over authenticity and truth are waged, starting with TikTok theology and the weaponization of the word.
Yeah, biblical scholar Dan McClellan is doing important work on social media, fighting the vast gap between academic and lay understanding of the Bible.
What's his core insight?
His core insight is that because the text has no inherent meaning, it must be interpreted by a human agent. Whoever interprets it best in support of their ideology can leverage that ultimate authority for political or social gain.
And the sources show how easily this ultimate authority is weaponized. For example, right-wing religious discussions of the sin of empathy.
Completely non-biblical, according to McClellan's textual analysis. That notion is merely an ideological attempt to overturn the fact that humans are social creatures predisposed to empathy for survival.
Using religious authority to justify selfishness.
Essentially. This tendency to bend the text for power is also clear in the prosperity gospel.
Ah.
The gospel systematically ignores the clear hyperbolic warning from Jesus about the camel passing through the eye of the needle being easier than a rich man entering heaven. Instead, prosperity preachers assure followers that honoring Israel or giving generously will bring God's financial blessing,
thereby justifying immense wealth and political power.
Right. McClellan states clearly, folks who love power more than they love people are causing a lot of the social ills that we have today. And unfortunately, the Bible is very frequently one of the main instruments in the hands of those people.
So this illustrates that the control of narrative and information, even real disinformation, is central to maintaining the power structures we've been discussing throughout this deep dive.
Absolutely. And that leads us to the parallel battle for authenticity on the artistic front. The vulnerability of native art to forgery.
The creative economy is absolutely vital to native communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Up to 85% of households in Zuni Pueblo include a working artist.
Their culture is their livelihood. But for centuries, this community has faced a marketplace that undervalues their work and is rife with cheap knockoffs, mostly manufactured abroad.
In the new digital marketplaces, while offering artists autonomy, they've increased the risk of plagiarism.
Dramatically. As artists noted in the sources, they are struggling with the copying of our identity.
What's the main legal protection? The Indian Arts and Crafts Act, or ICA?
Yes. For you listening, IACA mandates that anything described as an Indian product must be produced by an enrolled tribal member. However, IACA is poorly enforced.
Oh, poorly.
The sources cite an example of one shop fined $300,000 for importing hundreds of thousands of knockoffs that remains in operation 5 years later.
Showing that even when the legal framework is sound, enforcement is weak.
Very weak. The sources detail artist Marlo Kiyde's dilemma. She's worried about publishing images of her unique Zuni fetishes online, even after taking precautions like imprinting her initials.
Because her unique style is already being copied and mass-produced overseas.
Exactly. E-commerce is a blessing for autonomy, but a curse for protection.
And while the IACA enforcement is weak, the source notes that cuts to the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities further strain the nonprofits that support these artists and help them prove authenticity.
Right. The battle over native art is essentially a microcosm of the global fight over cultural ownership and economic vulnerability in the digital age, where those with power can profit off the identity of the marginalized.
Wow. We have covered a huge swath of investigations in this comprehensive deep dive. From the rapidly constructed federal gulag and the massive non-competitive contracts that fund it.
To the economic pain those actions cause, even in supporting communities like Ogden.
We've also explored the surprising power of prophecy-driven religious entities to shape foreign policy in the Middle East.
And the political hypocrisy that seems to govern domestic energy and financial policy. The core takeaway, really, is the immense scale and speed of the administration's agenda.
Leveraging political loyalty, ideological purity, and unprecedented cash to execute its vision.
Right. And the response, whether it's California's aggressive soft secession, Rep. Caesar's pragmatic push for political power, or the desperate work of federal whistleblowers, shows the intensity of the pushback.
It all underscores that politics in late 2025 is fundamentally a two-front war. It's not just a battle for legislation and votes.
It's a conflict over defining reality itself, whether it's the reality of an able-bodied recipient, a natural source of wealth, or the true meaning of a sacred text.
So this deep dive gives you, the listener, the informed foundation to watch these conflicts play out. The sources show that the cost of maintaining or fighting against those carefully constructed realities is escalating across every front.
From the personal tragedy of a laid-off IRS worker to the global consequence of a prophecy-driven foreign policy.
What stands out to you about that escalating cost?
We thank you for taking this deep dive with us. We'll see you next time.